Dr. Lehrman, I think we'll go.
Okay, thank you. First, I want to thank you for holding this hearing, thank the members of your staff who helped to put this together. I'm a psychologist and I'm a behavioral scientist.
Could you move the mic closer,
sure.
please?
I'm a psychologist and a behavioral scientist studying genetic testing for cancer susceptibility, and I'm pleased to testify on the ethical, legal, and social issues involved in genetic testing for cancer. We've heard about these great scientific achievements, we've heard about the potential medical benefits and potential quality life benefits associated with genetic testing for cancer, and although these are significant, the imminent availability of these tests also raises new questions and concerns that should be addressed before this new technology is made more widely and commercially available. What information do individuals need to have in order to make informed decisions about whether to have a genetic test for cancer susceptibility? Among those who decide to be tested, what are the psychological and social risks associated with the knowledge of one's own genetic status? Given that the potential for discrimination on the basis of genetic status is one of the most serious risks, what safeguards must be in place to protect carriers of cancer predisposing genes from losing their employment or insurance? And I'll address these issues briefly in my testimony. First, it's actually useful to consider what the likely demand for these tests is going to be. Recent studies that have been conducted suggest that there's very strong interest in genetic testing, both in the general population and among individuals at high risk for cancer. In one recent study, 91% of women who had a mother, sister, or daughter with breast cancer reported that they would want to have a genetic test for breast cancer susceptibility when it's available. And in an ongoing study in which BRCA1 testing is actually being offered to members of high-risk families in the particular research study, 71% of individuals in these families decided to receive their test results. So it suggests that the interest and uptake of this testing is going to be great once it's made more widely available. Now, Mr. Brad Marcus discussed the individual's right to decide whether to be tested, and I agree, and this is a very critical issue. What I would emphasize is that in order for this decision to be informed, the decision to be tested, individuals must understand the limitations and risks of these tests as well as the benefits. And yet, available data most recently suggest that some genetic testing decisions currently are being based on misunderstanding of the benefits and limitations of these tests, and I'll give you some examples. In a recent study that we conducted in women who are at low to moderate risk, that is not part of these high-risk families, two of the most widely cited reasons that they gave for wanting BRCA1 testing were to be reassured and to learn about my children's risks. While these benefits of genetic testing may be accrued by members of high-risk families, this is not necessarily the case for other individuals. For example, a woman at low to moderate risk of breast cancer, for her, a negative BRCA1 test result would not decrease her risk status or that of her children. For as we've heard, breast cancer could still arise in a woman's because of changes in a woman's breast cells over her lifetime, and all women who test negative for BRCA1 would still carry a minimum lifetime risk of about 12%, which is the population risk. Another motivation for BRCA1 testing is to have preventive surgery if the test result is positive, to have one's breasts removed or ovaries removed. And this was reported by 88% of women in an ongoing study, that this would be a reason they would want to be tested. However, in these...
Even sure, if they don't have...
No, if they were positive for the mutation.
Wow.
Yeah, even if they don't have cancer yet. The women were saying one of the reasons for wanting to know if they're a carrier of this mutation that places them at high risks is so they could have their breasts or ovaries removed before they develop cancer, so preventively.
88% said that?
Said that that was a reason, a somewhat or very important reason why they would want to have a BRCA1 test. And this was, these were women in who were part of high-risk families in the context of a research study. And we asked them reasons why they would want testing, reasons why they wouldn't want testing, how important these reasons were to them.
How big was the sample?
This particular data right here are about 175 people in this study. And interestingly, though, in these same women where we also assessed knowledge, fewer than one half of these women were aware that having one's breasts or ovaries removed will not definitely prevent cancer. that there's still, although these techniques reduce risk, there still is some residual risk. And in fact, we don't know exactly what that risk is in individuals who have a mutation in a cancer predisposing gene. So although they're reporting this as a reason, at the same time, they're not aware that this is not a foolproof procedure for prevention. So my point is not to minimize how important these medical benefits are and how important genetic testing may be, but to emphasize that there are also limitations and risks, and that to make informed decisions, men and women need to be aware of not only the benefits, but the limitations and risks. Unfortunately, though, although healthcare providers could be in a position to educate their patients, studies suggest that they're really ill-equipped to do this, because, in fact, the first point I want to make is that primary healthcare providers, actually, I think it's likely that they may be on the front lines of providing these tests. There's currently reported to be 1,200 genetic counselors in this country, and currently the demand for these tests will outstrip the availability of genetic counselors. At the same time, these tests are already being marketed aggressively to physicians in their primary care practices, so I think the pressure for them to provide these tests in clinical practice is going to be great. But studies suggest they have limited knowledge. A recent survey about genetics and genetic testing was administered to over 1,000 primary care physicians, and on the average, these providers answered fewer than 75% of the questions about genetics correctly. And this isn't surprising, since in most medical schools currently, little attention is given to genetics. And to address this, the American Society of Human Genetics has recommended that there be a large-scale educational initiative for primary care providers who may be called upon to provide these tests. But in order to provide this information to their patients, the scientific community needs to gather additional data about what these limitations and possible risks are. So we've heard from Dr. Klausner and Dr. Collins about the basic science and medical outcomes data that are required. But in addition to this, I would argue that we need to learn more about the psychological risks of learning that one is a carrier in a cancer predisposing gene. And there are anecdotal data available from BRCA1 testing programs that suggest that this knowledge can create a significant emotional burden. And adverse psychological effects have even been observed in people who test negative for cancer predisposing genes, such as worrying, still continuing to worry that they'll develop breast cancer, or feeling guilty that one was spared a fate that was shared by many of their family members.
So let me just ask you a question.
Sure.
How broad a base individuals were involved in those psychological tests?
Well, actually, the anecdotal data I'm reporting are based on a very small sample of individuals, of maybe one or two families that are reported in the literature. We really need empirical data from well-designed, large-scale trials. And Dr. Collins mentioned the consortium, and that's exactly what these studies are designed to evaluate, exactly what the psychological and social risks of testing are in large samples in well-designed studies. And my main point here is that those data are not yet available, and so we don't know what the psychological and social risks are. But based on the small numbers, it tells us the kinds of things that we should look for. And then, in order for a consumer to make an informed decision, they also need to know about the social risks. And as we've heard today from many people, one of the most important of these is the potential for genetic discrimination. Once an individual receives a genetic test for cancer susceptibility, this information becomes a permanent part of his or her medical record. And as we've heard, the specific concern is that they'll be denied opportunities in employment or access to affordable health insurance. One survey conducted by the Office of Technology Assessment of the U.S. Congress found that 3/4 of insurance company executives agreed with the statement, an insurer should have the option of determining how to use genetic information in determining risk. And also reported was that 14% of genetic counselors reported having patients who had difficulty acquiring or maintaining insurance after genetic testing. And Dr. Collins actually gave an estimate from another study that suggested that it's higher. The other point I wanted to make about this is that this possibility, even the possibility for insurance discrimination, raises very difficult conflicts for providers and for consumers. We found that lack of insurance coverage may be a significant barrier to receiving testing. In the study that we're conducting, out of the first 175 people offered testing, 72% of persons who had health insurance decided to receive their test results, but only 43% of individuals without health insurance decided to do so. So this may be an important barrier.
Say that to me again.
We offered the we were looking at factors that were associated with the decision to receive BRCA1 test results in men and women in these high-risk families. And test results are actually being offered in this research study. 72% among those who had health insurance, 72% decided to receive the results and, in fact, did receive the results. But only 43% of uninsured individuals made the decision to receive the results. We need to study this more thoroughly, but that suggests to me that perhaps lack of insurance coverage may be a barrier. And as part of the same study, in fact, I think 36% of individuals said that concerns about loss of insurance or not being able to obtain insurance were an important reason for not being tested. So it suggests that this weighs
on patients. Was that a reason that they offered, that they took the initiative, or were there certain questions asked of them as to why they made these decisions?
These surveys were actually closed-ended surveys asking them to rate how important a series of different reasons would be. And among the reasons not to be tested, concerns about insurance were, I think, one of the two most important reasons, the other being concerns about the effect it would have on one's family. Interestingly,
if I could, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up.
Sure. The other point that I want to make is that even if patients don't provide this information to their insurance companies, their physicians may do so, even sometimes without the patient's permission. And one survey showed that 24% of providers said they would disclose genetic information to employers, and 12% would disclose to insurance companies, even without the patient's permission. So even though patients may decide not to tell, their doctors might. And the final point that I want to make before I wrap up is that insurance concerns also appear to be affecting patients' decisions about whether to receive medical interventions. In the same study, 10 out of 68 women from hereditary breast ovarian cancer families indicated that insurance concerns had influenced their decisions whether to have preventive surgery, because in fact what's being reported that they are afraid, for example, if they can't afford to pay out of pocket and they want to go forward and request for payment from a surgery from their insurance company, that that knowledge that the insurance company may have may make their children uninsurable. So then finally, to summarize, I want to mention again what's been mentioned, that the American Society of Human Genetics and the National Center for Human Genome Research have recommended that genetic testing for cancer susceptibility initially be conducted in a carefully monitored research environment. And I want to say that the intent is not to prevent people from having access to these tests, but instead to ensure that this testing is done in a quality way, in an effective and ethical way. And in some cases, this can increase access by making these tests available free of charge, as opposed to the, you know, $1,000 or more charge that's been quoted by some commercial companies. Finally, just to give the four justifications for this, the scientific community should have the opportunity to gather the information needed to ascertain the benefits, limitations, and risks of testing, as well as the options for prevention and screening. Second, the proliferation of genetic tests in the medical marketplace should be scrutinized to ensure that these benefits outweigh the risk. And third, educational initiatives should be undertaken to ensure that providers of genetic testing are well-trained and adequately informed themselves. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, federal legislation should be enacted to protect against insurance discrimination, to ensure that all individuals, including those with a genetic predisposition to cancer, have equal access to health insurance and to quality health care. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm going to